content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And, of course, this week I'll be reading from the Friday edition dated February 18th, 2011. We'll begin reading today from the main stories in The Week magazine. The first item in this particular edition is entitled, Protesters Regime Headed for a Showdown. What happened? A surge of anti-government protests in Egypt this past week intensified pressure on President Hosni Mubarak to step down as his regime issued ominous warnings that the two sides could be headed toward a violent confrontation. The White House threw its support behind Omar Suleiman, the new vice president handpicked by Mubarak, with the Obama administration urging meaningful negotiations between the protesters and the government to ensure a smooth transition of power. But Suleiman dug in his heels, insisting that he and Mubarak would remain in power until the president's term ends in September. In response, strikes marked by violence broke out across the country, and crowds defied the government by continuing to mass in Cairo's Tahrir, which is Liberation Square, and in smaller cities throughout the country. We can't bear this for a long time, Suleiman said of the demonstrations, adding darkly, we don't want to deal with Egyptian society with police tools. To buy time, Suleiman met earlier in the week with 50 leaders of the revolt, including two members of the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood. Suleiman pledged to guarantee press freedoms and to repeal emergency laws that have been used to crush opposition for the past 30 years, but only once the country was ready. Egypt, he said, would have democracy only when the people develop the culture of democracy. Opposition groups vowed to continue the uprising until Mubarak's government falls. Now, here's what the editorials had to say about all of this. Once again, America is abandoning its friends when the going gets tough, said the Washington Times. Hosni Mubarak has been a staunch U.S. ally for 30 years, providing crucial logistical support in the two Gulf Wars and acting as a bulwark against a rising wave of Islamic radicalism in the Middle East. So why is the Obama administration undermining him and Suleiman, another reliable pro-Western ally, with inept political signaling and by insisting on regime change as fast as possible? The U.S. is caught in a conflict between its values and its interests, said the Detroit News. In the Mideast, American presidents have consistently chosen stability over democracy, which is why they've consistently supported dictators in Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and in decades past, Iran. But the revolt against Mubarak has forced the U.S. to hear Egyptians' demands for freedom. We have little choice but to shake off our cynicism and support real reform. Unfortunately, said the New York Times, the White House badly miscalculated when it backed Suleiman, who seems intent on maintaining as much of the old repressive order as possible. His panel to change the Constitution, handpicked by Mubarak, martial law still in place, democracy maybe someday. Now here's what the columnists had to say. The danger of chaos is real, said Fareed Zakaria in the Washington Post. Let's not be paralyzed by our fear that this is another Iranian revolution bound to end in a hostile Islamic government. For decades, Egypt has been run by its largely secular military, and the real danger is that the country will wind up like Pakistan, a sham democracy with real power held in back rooms by generals. It's that scenario with the U.S. backing yet another repressive regime that could give rise to a more hardline, more religious, and more violent opposition. No matter how this turns out, said Ben Stein in the American Spectator, it's not going to be good for America. Of that I'm sure. The people demonstrating in Egypt today are not liberal Democrats who will grant rights to minorities and promote religious freedom. They're not even our friends, and they're definitely not Israel's friends. Ah, but this revolution is not about us, said John Heilman in New York. It's a local organic bottom-up phenomenon, and despite some understandable confusion, the Obama administration has actually responded with skillful real politic, allying itself with the freedom movement, applying gentle pressure to the regime, and trying to ensure an orderly transition to a functioning democracy. The real question now is, what comes after whatever comes next, said George Will in the Washington Post. In the end, the U.S. is powerless in the face of this whirlwind, just as it is much of the Islamic world. Egyptians will tell us how it ends. Our next article from the week this week is, The Jobs Are Still Missing. Despite several positive signs that the economy is rebounding in earnest, a new jobs report indicates that employers are still not hiring. The economy only added 36,000 jobs in January, the Labor Department's monthly report indicated last week, with the unemployment rate falling 0.4% to 9.0%. Analysts had expected a gain of about 146,000 jobs. Construction trades shed 32,000 jobs as harsh weather in much of the U.S. halted many building projects, partially offsetting strong gains in manufacturing, which added about 49,000 jobs. Economists generally agree that reducing unemployment significantly will require monthly job gains of about 200,000. The jobs report clashed with other, more upbeat indicators, including increased consumer spending, rising corporate profits, and a robust stock market. The Standard & Poor's 500 stock index is up more than 5% in 2011. The economy does seem to be gaining some momentum, said Len Reiser of the National Association of Business Economics. Is the glass half full or half empty? Asked Ozzy Salmon in Barron's. The contrast between weak job creation and dramatic drop in unemployment is jarring, but there is an explanation. The Labor Department derives the job creation number from a survey of employers. It calculates unemployment from a survey of households. The product of this mixed methodology says more about the unreliability of job set statistics than the actual employment situation itself. Wasn't the recent extension of Bush-era tax cuts for the wealthy supposed to open the floodgates in hiring? Asked Elliot Spitzer in Slate.com. Instead, the promised jobs are nowhere to be seen, while the budget deficit is exploding. It was no coincidence that the last time we enjoyed both a hiring boom and a budget surplus, it was preceded by Bill Clinton's tax hikes on the wealthy. This is a different era, said Erwin Stelzer in the WeeklyStandard.com. The latest employment report tells a story of semi-jobless recovery, which might well be more than a passing phenomenon. Some industries will never again need the number of workers they hired before the recession. Those who lost jobs will have to sharpen their skills and reacquire the habit of work. In this tough new environment, the Obama administration's vague calls to improve education and job training are coming up short. The next item today, GOP sets up budget battle. A House committee this week passed a Republican plan to trim $32 billion from federal spending in the 7 months remaining before Washington's fiscal year ends in September. The plan, authored by House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan, would cut $40 billion from labor, health, education, and transportation, foreign aid, and other programs, while increasing defense spending. Washington's spending spree is over, Ryan declared. President Obama will release his own budget next week, setting up a contest between the president's plan, which will likely freeze spending at 2010 levels, and Republican efforts to roll back some spending to 2008 levels. However, some Democrats oppose any significant spending cuts, saying they'll harm a fragile economic recovery. Some Republicans, meanwhile, want to honor a GOP campaign promise to cut $100 billion this year. All the GOP's righteous indignation and bloviated anger have summoned forth a hairball, said Robert Reich in BusinessInsider.com, recognizing that Americans don't want Americans don't want big spending cuts. Republicans aren't even pretending to attack Social Security, Medicare, and defense, which is where the real money is. This is embarrassing. Mostly it's predictable, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com. It's easy to do deficit reduction in the abstract. Making specific cuts to food safety, education, border security, and the like is very, very hard. Since entitlement spending eats up more than half the budget, no credible plan can leave Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid unscathed, said William Kristol in TheWeeklyStandard.com. Yet that's precisely what this worrisome bill does. Surely the fire-up House freshman will insist on a serious GOP budget. But there's wisdom in Ryan's measured approach, said the National Review Online in an editorial. He recognizes the daunting political challenge that deficit reduction poses. A 5 or 10 year effort that continually reduces federal spending is vastly preferable to an attempt to achieve everything in a single shot that misses. The Ryan plan represents an actual honest-to-God reduction from the current spending level of $1.087 trillion. If Ryan's budget is enacted, Republicans will have a real accomplishment right off the bat. And now let's take a look at the controversy of the week in The Week magazine. It's entitled, Social Media, Are Facebook and Twitter Tools of Revolution? Did Twitter make them do it? Asked Jesse Lichtenstein and Slate.com. With hundreds of thousands of Egyptians still massing this week in Tahrir Square in defiance of a severely weakened regime, fans of social media are pointing to the role of Facebook and Twitter in sparking yet another revolution. In similar popular uprisings in Yemen, Tunisia, and Iran over the past year, social media played a key role helping dissidents form connections and organize protests. That was even more true in Egypt, said Jennifer Preston in the New York Times. The uprising there was sparked by the death of Khaled Said, a 28-year-old businessman who was beaten to death by police last year after he obtained a proof of police corruption. Human rights activists created a Facebook page called We Are All Khaled Said, featuring a photo of his grotesquely disfigured face. And within weeks, the page had 130,000 followers, growing to nearly 500,000 as the street protests began several weeks ago, organized partly by tweets and text messages. In authoritarian regimes around the world, Facebook and Twitter are allowing the discontented to organize and mobilize in ways they never could before. Tell that to Lenin, said Malcolm Gladwell in the New Yorker. I could have sworn that both the Russian and French revolutions took place before the Internet came along. The East Germans who overthrew their government and tore down the Berlin Wall in the 1980s didn't even own phones, let alone smartphones or computers. Under despotic regimes, brave souls willing to fight for freedom will always find ways to communicate, whether by iPhone, furtively passed handbills and pamphlets, or urgent whispers in the street. Our fixation on the social media angle of these revolutions betrays a simplistic Western chauvinism, said Frank Rich in the New York Times. We love the thought that these downtrodden, unwashed masses are only able to free themselves thanks to the tools we gave them. Besides, said Lee Siegel in the New York Observer, the power of the social media cuts both ways. In Iran, the regime actually spied on dissidents involved in the Green Revolution through Facebook and sent out misleading tweets. 19 months later, the regime is still in office, carefully monitoring the opposition through the Internet. In the short term, said Clay Shirky in Foreign Affairs, the advent of new communication technologies is just as likely to strengthen authoritarian regimes as it is to weaken them. The Chinese government, for example, has evolved beyond some early crude attempts to block the Internet altogether, and now has developed sophisticated systems for controlling the political threats from social media, and for using them as a tool of manipulation and surveillance. In the long run, though, said Walter Isaacson in Foreign Policy Review, social media can only be bad news for authoritarian regimes. The free flow of information is the oxygen of democracy, and there's no disputing that the Internet, smartphones, and social media have radically increased and accelerated that flow. It's not the tools themselves, said Jose Antonio Vargas in HuffingtonPost.com. It's the new sense of community and togetherness that those tools have made possible. Protesters on the streets of Cairo, Tunis, and Tehran are united not only by their thirst for freedom and self-rule, but by a new awareness brought about by a new technology of their common humanity. Online, the individual can be heard, and in a matter of a few keystrokes, I easily grows to we. And now it's time to take a look at the popular feature in the Week magazine called A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. Well, it was a good week for civic pride after Fort Wayne, Indiana residents cast thousands of online votes to name the city's new government center the Harry Bales Building after a beloved former mayor. City officials said the suggestion was fun, but that we're not going to make any decisions that look bad. It was a good week for taking the stairs after Thomas Dold, a 26-year-old German, won the Empire State Building run-up for the sixth year in a row. He ran up all 1,576 steps in 10 minutes and 10 seconds. And it was a good week for Scorpios after the Allstate Insurance Company released a study that found that Scorpios had the fewest car accidents last year, while Virgos had the most. Allstate assured customers that astrological signs have absolutely no role in how we set the rates. It was a bad week for downsizing after a new study found that the average American worker's personal workspace shrank from 90 square feet in 1994 to 75 square feet last year. It was a bad week for smokers after New York City banned outdoor smoking in parks, beaches, and busy public areas like Times Square. New Yorkers who go to our parks and beaches for some fresh air and fun will be able to breathe even cleaner air, said Mayor Michael Bloomberg. And it was a bad week for Kenneth Cole, the designer, who sparked outrage by using the Egyptian Revolution as the basis for a publicity campaign on Twitter. Millions are in uproar in #Cairo, he tweeted. Rumor is that they heard that our new spring collection is now available online at bit.ly/kcairo. Cole apologized for his insensitivity. And now let's turn to the People's section from the Week magazine dated February 18th. The first item is Haggard's Fall from the Pulpit. Ted Haggard is a humbled man, said Kevin Roos in GQ. Haggard was one of the nation's most visible evangelicals as pastor of the 10,000-member New Life Church in Colorado Springs. It all came crashing down when a male escort named Mike Jones came forward in 2006 with scandalous allegations that Haggard had paid him for sex and crystal methamphetamines. We never had sex, Haggard says today, while conceding that sexual contact and drug use had occurred. As part of his separation agreement with New Life, he was banned from any contact with church members. I used to think the church was the light of the world, he says sadly, but I've completely lost my faith in it. He started a new ministry in Colorado Springs for sinners like himself. I don't judge people anymore. I know life happens to somebody. Sometimes it's self-imposed, Other times it's imposed from the outside, but I think we're qualified to hold people's hands when they go through that. He's repaired his marriage and says he still believes that homosexuality is not God's best plan for people, but he no longer denies he's attracted to men. I think if I were 21 in this society, I would identify myself as bisexual. Through effort and prayer, he says, it's not a temptation anymore. Still, he remains a pariah to many old friends, and his scars are deep. People are, at their cores, hateful. I don't want to believe that, but the facts have prevailed over my idealism, says Haggard. The next item, entitled, Still Waiting for Her Audience. Concepcion Picciotto has led a single-minded life, said Chris Coronado in the Washington Post. Since 1981, Picciotto has spent every day camped out across the street from the White House, protesting against the proliferation of nuclear weapons. From her spot on the sidewalk in front of Lafayette Square Park, Picciotto holds an array of homemade signs, one of which depicts photos of victims of the Hiroshima bombing, with the caption, "Stay the course, and this will happen to you." Reticent around reporters, she's less so with tourists and other passers-by. "I'm here because of you," she says to one group. "If you people were more concerned, we wouldn't have to be here." She vows to keep up her anti-nuclear vigil until someone in the White House takes notice. Over 30 years, no president from Reagan to Obama has stepped across the street to address her. "I'm very discouraged," she admits. The next item is called The Lothario in Winter. Jack Nicholson is no longer on the hunt, said Louise Gannon in the London Daily Mail. At age 73, the old lion finds that his power over women has finally waned. "There were points in my life where I felt oddly irresistible to women," he says. "I'm not in that state now, and that makes me sad. I'm definitely still wild at heart. But I've struck biogravity. I can't hit on women in public anymore. It just doesn't feel right at my age." Women, he says, have always been his raison d'etre. "If men are honest, everything they do and everywhere they go is for chance to see women." His wandering attentions, however, haven't made for lasting relationships for Jack Nicholson. "I've been in love in my life, but it always started with an obsession that usually lasts exactly 18 months, and then it changes." Though he's had a good run, he believes his prospects for finding love again are dim. "I've had everything a man could ask for, but I don't know if anyone could say I've been successful with affairs of the heart. I would love that one last real romance, but I'm not very realistic about that happening." He pauses and adds wistfully, "What I can't deny is my yearning," according to Jack Nicholson. And I guess we'll just have to wait until another edition to find out how Jack Nicklaus feels about all of that. Apologize for the mistake there. Our next item from The Week magazine is from The Briefing, a weekly feature this week entitled The Muslim Brotherhood. All eyes are on Egypt's biggest opposition group, the Muslim Brotherhood. What are the Brotherhood's goals? What is the Muslim Brotherhood? The world's largest and most influential Islamic movement. Founded in Egypt in 1928, the group was originally focused on ridding the country of corrupting secular influences brought by British colonial rule. Over the years, it established branches and affiliates in many countries to promote traditional Sunni Islamic morals, social justice, and the eradication of poverty and corruption. The Islamic nation, its charter states, must be fully prepared to fight the tyrants and the enemies of Allah as a prelude to establishing an Islamic state, ideally a re-established caliphate stretching from Spain across the Middle East and Central Asia to Indonesia, to be governed according to Islamic Sharia law. But today's Muslim Brotherhood is not a monolithic organization, nor does it have a rigid doctrine. While many of its older members are deeply conservative, many of the younger ones are modern and reform-minded. Khaled Hamza, a voice of moderation within the group and the editor of the group's official website, says the Brotherhood would never support a rule by the clergy, as in Iran. "We do not believe Islam requires a theocracy," he says. "Democracy is the only way." How does the Brotherhood operate? Well, mostly through political activism and charity work. Even though it's officially banned in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood has hundreds of thousands of passionately committed members who provide health care and aid to the poor under the slogans "Islam is the solution" and "Jihad is our way." The Brotherhood runs hospitals, schools, banks, daycare centers, community centers, and facilities for the disabled in cities and towns all over the country. While members can't run for office under the Muslim Brotherhood banner, they do run as independents. In the 2005 election, members took 20% of the open seats in Parliament to form the single largest opposition bloc. But in last November's first round of parliamentary elections, which were heavily rigged by the Mubarak regime, the Brotherhood won no seats and joined a general boycott. Widespread anger over those stolen elections is a major factor in the current uprising. Why was the group banned? Originally, it was implicated in a failed attempt to assassinate President Gamal Abdel Nasser in 1954. After that, thousands of Brotherhood members were tortured under the Nasser regime, and the group went underground. At that time, Saeed Qutb, a Muslim Brotherhood leader, began arguing that Egyptians would wage jihad to bring about Islamic rule. His writings are a main inspiration to radical Islamic groups throughout the world, including Al-Qaeda. The 1964 work Milestones, in particular, is influential for the way it splits the world into two camps, Islam and Jahili, the state of ignorance. All governments and peoples who do not follow true Islam as the Brotherhood sees it are considered Jahili and should be confronted and changed. Militant Islamic groups frequently invoke milestones to justify the use of violence against the West. Is the Brotherhood still violent? Its leaders now renounce violence, at least publicly. The Brotherhood says its call to jihad is spiritual and that it believes in advancing Islam through politics and teaching. Its members in Parliament are educated professionals who have proved to be competent and savvy legislators, only too open to compromise. In fact, the group's insistence on nonviolence caused Egyptian surgeon Ayman al-Zawahiri to leave the Muslim Brotherhood in the late 1980s and eventually join Osama bin Laden as al-Qaeda's number two. Hamas, the militant Palestinian group that controls the Gaza Strip and strongly advocates violent struggle, began as an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. But Hamas's ties to the Egyptian group are now tenuous. What is its stance toward Israel and the United States? Unremittingly negative. In past decades, the group had a blatantly anti-Semitic agenda, translating Hitler's Mein Kampf and the forged protocols of the Elders of Zion into Arabic and disseminating them to foment hatred of the Jews. More recently, it has contented itself with railing against U.S. and Zionist domination. The Brotherhood does not recognize Israel, and it crossed sectarian lines to openly support the Shiite militant group Hezbollah during the 2006 Lebanese war with Israel. Recently, Brotherhood leaders have given mixed signals about whether they would actually seek to abandon Egypt's 1979 peace treaty with Israel. Will the Brotherhood wind up ruling Egypt? That's unlikely, most observers say. After Mubarak leaves, Islam will probably play a larger and more assertive role in Egyptian society. But unlike Iran's Shiites, Egypt's Sunnis see the clergy merely as spiritual advisors, not as rulers to be obeyed absolutely. They are rebelling for more freedom, not less, and the powerful military would resist an Islamic dictatorship. The Muslim Brotherhood can hope for is 20% of the seats in the Egyptian parliament, says Hani Shadi, an Egyptian journalist. Secular parties will likely emerge to balance that out, but experts are divided on whether the Brotherhood's new, more moderate line marks a real change or a ruse. It would be delusory to take the Muslim Brotherhood's democratic protestations at face value, says Leslie Gelb, a former president of the Council on Foreign Relations. No one really has any sound idea of how they might rule. And the footnote to this briefing article this week, role in the uprising. In the past, Mubarak regime was quick to label any protest an Islamist coup threat and respond by cracking down hard on the Muslim Brotherhood. So the group kept a low profile in the current uprising. It did not officially join the protests for more than a week and refrained from promoting its slogans or religious symbols. Now it has thrown its support to secular opposition leader Mohammed El-Baradei, the former head of the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency. "We demand that this regime be overthrown, and we demand the formation of a national unity government for all the factions," the Brotherhood said in a statement last week. Going forward, the group is certain to have a key role in Egyptian politics. "If we really want democracy in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood is going to be a big part of the picture," said Bruce Rydell of the Brookings Institution. "Rather than demonizing them, we ought to start engaging them now." You're listening to The Week magazine for February 18th, 2011. Now let's take a look at the best columns of the United States in the United States this week. As determined by The Week, the first one is entitled "Israel Must Face Up to New Facts" by Peter Beinart, and he is with thedailybeast.com. Is the Egyptian revolution bad for Israel's? "Israelis and American Jews understandably fear that it is," said Peter Beinart. "But in fact, the democracy movement is doing Israel a favor. After Hosni Mubarak departs, no democratic Egyptian government will continue to collude with Israel's brutal blockade of Gaza, which Israeli officials admit, in a recent WikiLeaks dump, is designed to keep the Gazan economy on the brink of collapse. That short-sighted policy has actually strengthened Hamas's grip on Gaza. Its corrupt leaders can blame the misery of the Palestinian people on the American Zionist boogeyman, while blocking the peace efforts of more moderate Palestinian leaders. Those leaders, as another WikiLeaks cable revealed, truly are willing to negotiate with Israel to create a Palestinian state. The Middle East's tectonic plates are shifting, and for its own good, the region's most vibrant democracy has to end its own profoundly anti-democratic policies. The next Tahrir Square could be in Ramallah or East Jerusalem, and Israel could find itself facing an ugly revolt. Palestinian kids use Facebook, too. The next column, "Why I'm Not Celebrating Black History Month," by Colbert King, from the Washington Post. "Pardon me if I don't feel like celebrating Black History Month," said Colbert King. "Once again, African Americans will spend a few weeks looking back to great men and women of the past while we ignore the calamity in our midst, the destruction of the black family. In 1950, nearly 80% of black families had two parents. Today, only 38% do, and the majority of black children are growing up with struggling single mothers. The result, an ongoing epidemic of dropouts, crime, child abuse, and relentless poverty. This should be no surprise. Children need fathers. and it's well established that kids from broken homes are far less likely to succeed in life. The boys turn to crime and drugs and end up in jail. The girls turn to sex and wind up pregnant, perpetuating the cycle of misery. How has society responded? By making teen pregnancy easier with food stamps, cash assistance, medical coverage, and foster care. Meanwhile, good-for-nothing fathers hop from one baby mama to the next without any consequences. We can blame society or racism, if we like, for our messed-up kids. But an intergenerational cycle of dysfunction is unfolding before our eyes, and only African Americans can stop it. The next column is entitled, Government is Not Always the Problem, and it's by Dick Pohlman in the Philadelphia Inquirer. When the Obama administration bailed out the auto industry 2 years ago, said Dick Pohlman, outraged conservatives predicted disaster. U.S. Representative John Boehner said the rescue effort guarantees failure at taxpayer expense, and Senator John McCain scoffed that if it were people who believe that Chrysler is going to survive, I'd love to meet them. Newt Gingrich went so far as to predict that Chrysler taxes would cause the population to rise up in revolt. Guess what? The free market purists were dead wrong. GM has emerged from bankruptcy stronger than Ford, with billions in profits and a claim for vastly improved quality and reliability. Chrysler has increased its new sales every month for the past 9 months and will soon roll out 16 new models. The federal government's bailout dollars are well on the way to being repaid. Hundreds of thousands of jobs that would have been permanently lost have been saved. Indeed, the U.S. auto industry has added 53,000 workers since 2009. The lesson? Sometimes government needs to step in to save capitalism from its worst Darwinian excesses. Now let's turn to The Last Word, a weekly feature in The Week magazine. The one this week is entitled, Rescue Me. Michael Ferrara was a prince among Aspen's elite alpine rescuers, but the mountain took a dreadful toll. Michael Ferrara has trouble pinpointing the exact moment when his life began to unravel. A plausible starting point, though, might be March 29, 2001. The weather was snowy and cold on that evening nearly 10 years ago. 15 friends from Los Angeles, most of them in their late 20s, had chartered a jet for a few days of spring skiing to celebrate a buddy's birthday. Something went wrong on the final descent into Aspen Small Airport. The pilot apparently couldn't see the runway. A wingtip caught the ground, the plane flipped, and the tail segment broke off. Then the plane exploded into flames. Ferrara, who at the time was both a Pitkin County Sheriff's deputy and an assistant coroner, was among the first to arrive. He had worked on a half-dozen small-engine plane crashes in the mountains around Aspen. As a paramedic, a ski patroller, a high-angle rescuer, and an avalanche specialist, he'd often dealt with blood and trauma. Among scores of incidents, he was first on the scene when Robert Kennedy's son Michael Kennedy, 39, fatally struck a tree while skiing in Aspen in 1997. Steeped in the stoic culture of the first responder, Ferrara instinctively took charge in chaotic situations, but he wasn't prepared for this. The first charred and bloodied body he came upon was still buckled to his seat, his cell phone ringing in his pocket. Then out of the corner of his eye, Ferrara saw something jammed into the elk fence, a hunk of flesh dripping with serous fluid. Ferrara spent that terrible evening with fellow officers assembling body parts into plastic bags. All 18 people, including the crew, were killed. Ferrara got home at 4 in the morning, smelling like jet fuel. He stripped out of his gore-smeared clothes and left them in the front yard. Nobody comes to Aspen thinking something like this is going to happen, he says. They look at these beautiful mountains and they see paradise. I look at these same mountains and sometimes I see another side. Ferrara landed in Aspen in 1979 from a small town near Buffalo, New York. He was 29 years old, a hard-charging, hard-partying, slightly outrageous, but extremely competent tough guy who liked to live on the edge. Ferrara quickly learned the calculus of thrill and risk that abides in the richest, fittest, most overachieving of alpine towns. He raced motorcycles and skydived and climbed desert spires and ran ultramarathons and skied like a beast. But he also saved lives. In the town's highly accomplished world of search and rescue paramedics, he was one of the very best. "I'm only half-joking when I say that I'd lie there an extra hour to have him come rescue me," says Doug Rovira, an expedition physician who worked with Ferrara. Ferrara is a handsome guy, a former bodybuilder with bulging biceps, a barrel chest, and a strong, clear voice that gets your attention. He has frosty blue eyes and a chiseled face reminiscent of Clint Eastwood. He's in terrific shape for a man of 60, yet there are hints of pain in his step from a life of sports injuries. "If you play the games of the mountains," he says, "you're going to get hurt." It was the possibility of emotional injury that Ferrara hadn't counted on. Yet in December of 2008, after months of downward spiraling, he experienced a devastating breakdown and was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. Fellow Aspen first responders were shocked. PTSD was supposed to happen to soldiers on a jittery battlefield far from home, not in a Xanadu dedicated to strenuous good fun. There are an estimated 24 million cases of post-traumatic stress syndrome in the U.S., most of them likely veterans. Over the past decade, however, PTSD has become associated with firefighters, police officers, emergency techs, and other first responders whose jobs expose them to horrific scenes. Alpine first responders are beginning to recognize that dwelling in backcountry beauty does not inoculate one against tragedy. "PTSD is a sneaky player," says Dean Cardinale, the ski patrol director at Snowbird. "These stresses do affect us profoundly." After the 2001 plane crash, Ferrara continued to excel in his high-pressure work. In 2003, Pitkin County awarded him a commendation for bravery for actions above and beyond the call of duty. His reputation as a rock-solid rescuer spread beyond Aspen, and he found himself spending vacations doing what he did at work, going climbing and pulling bodies alive or dead from the mountains. In 2005, Ferrara patrolled on Denali with the National Park Service High Rescue Team. Yet it was taking a toll. Ferrara began to withdraw from his friends. He developed a blank stare. He went through several relationships. He started using Paracet, a narcotic painkiller. In the course of the day, he would cry for a few minutes, consumed by an overwhelming sadness referred to by some PTSD sufferers as flooding. At other times, he was overtaken by what he called the slideshow, a cruel flickering of mental images, an eviscerated body, a father in the ambulance with his critically injured skateboarder son, those charred figures on the runway. He could hear Michael Kennedy's children saying the Lord's Prayer around their dying father in a mountain glade. He didn't just remember the traumas, he relived them. "The pictures were burned into his mind," Ferrara says. "They were happening right here, right now." Search and rescue veterans often speak of the particular horror of encountering freefall victims. You pick up an arm and it disarticulates. You see eyeballs exploded. You see brain matter in the trees, and the birds are eating everything, says Mark Beverly, an SAR trainer in Albuquerque. You're picking up people's teeth and putting them in Nalgene bottles. When you experience something like this, it's with you forever. Aspen's subculture of mountain athletes and first responders is a rarefied and often hyper-competitive world that takes a high premium of toughness and takes note of every stumble, too. It's a super intense town to work in, and the crowd Michael ran with was really charged up, says Dave Hahn, a world-renowned mountain guide and ski patroller in Taos, New Mexico. If you fail, you do it publicly. It's very difficult to keep your place in the hierarchy. People like Ferrara often end up having the most acute problems with PTSD. The bigger they are, the harder they fall, says SAR specialist Tim Kovacs of Arizona. In 2006, Ferrara quit the sheriff's department, but he was still working as a ski patroller on Aspen Mountain and as a paramedic to the Aspen Valley Hospital ER, while also volunteering for mountain rescues and recovery operations. He spent two more high-pressure seasons dragging hurt skiers off the mountains, digging corpses out of avalanches, and at times making dreadful calls to loved ones. Then one Sunday evening in 2008, he was working in the emergency room when a fellow paramedic told him, "There's been an avalanche on Aspen Mountain in the mid-country. The patrolman just found a skier. Michael, it's Corey." Corey Brettman was a beloved figure in Aspen, a veteran ski patroller and family man, and he was Ferrara's best friend. They'd ice climbed together, spent time in Alaska together, traveled wildly in the spirit of adventure. Ferrara cried when he heard the news, then met the ski patrol near the 1A lift at the base of Aspen Mountains. He opened up the litter and pulled back the blankets. Corey still had a tube in his mouth from the paramedics' resuscitation efforts, and his hair was caked with snow and blood. He'd suffered blunt trauma, tumbling in a wall of moving snow. He'd pinballed through a strand of trees, breaking a femur and multiple ribs before finally suffocating. Ferrara washed Corey's face and combed his hair so he'd be presentable to his wife. Then he took his friend to the morgue. "An emotional armor I had left. Corey's death shattered it," Ferrara says. "I was in a fog of despair. I couldn't see beauty anymore, only darkness. He couldn't sleep, couldn't think. The slideshow played without cease." By this point, Ferrara had begun to seriously abuse Paracet. "All I wanted was to medicate," he recalls. "I couldn't go back out there and face the mountain. I just couldn't do it anymore." As his substance abuse worsened, Ferrara burned bridges and frustrated colleagues. When the head of Aspen Mountain Ski Patrol confronted him about his erratic behavior in February 2009, Ferrara confessed to his addiction. Banished from the patrol room, his paramedic license rescinded, he broke down. Then he entered an intensive rehab program and began to consult psychiatrists at the University of Colorado's Depression Center. They had no trouble diagnosing him. Ferrara had many signs of PTSD, the combination of debilitating anxiety and severe depression, withdrawal, emotional flooding, the insomnia, the lack of eye contact, the memory stuck on merciless play. "I first met Ferrara on a misty, cold afternoon last winter. He was 11 months into his therapy. He stroked the sole patch on his chin and spoke with thoughtful detachment. 'I've got joy again,' he said. 'I'm running, I'm climbing, the slideshows have stopped.' He had been clean for a year. He was taking the antidepressant Zoloft and had sat through many months of cognitive behavior therapy sessions, sessions designed to unpack bad memories and relearn ways to restore and think about trauma. Ferrara has found a restorative power in physical activity that involves a rhythmic left-right action. Soldiers diagnosed with PTSD have found that vigorous repetitive motion exercise, such as ice skating and rollerblading, can be extremely helpful in keeping symptoms at bay. For many PTSD sufferers, the most helpful sport of all seems to be Nordic skiing. Ferrara has taken to it with a vengeance. Nearly every winter day, Ferrara and his dog hit the trails that twist like capillaries through Aspen's surrounding mountains. It was during those long hours of brisk solitude that Ferrara hit upon the idea that's animated him over the past year, the First Responder Recovery Project. In November, he launched a new website, frsos.com, filled with information about civilian PTSD and links to psychiatrists, therapists, clinics, and hospitals across the country. We need to create a whole new culture in which civilian first responders can openly talk about it, and we need to make good PTSD treatment as readily available to them as it is to soldiers, Ferrara says. To raise awareness for the project, Ferrara has done a most Ferrara-like, most Aspen-like thing. He's hatched an ambitious adventure. Starting the second week of March, He plans to ski across Alaska from the Pacific Ocean to the Arctic, from Valdez to Prudhoe Bay. The 900-mile trek, sponsored by Eddie Bauer, First Ascent, should take about 70 days. What Ferrara will do when he gets back is less clear. To pay his bills, he's patched together odd jobs. He's bucked hay on a nearby ranch, assisted at a home for developmentally disabled adults, done a little janitorial work, and served as a fitness trainer at Aspen's five-star Little Nell Hotel. If these jobs seem beneath the dignity of a man of his training and experience, the fact is he's grateful for the work. Ferrara knows he has to reinvent himself. He can't go back to ER work, and the search and rescue assignments he does accept will be fewer and farther between. He's talking about teaching or touring the country to spread the gospel about PTSD. It's okay to dial it back, Ferrara says, and it's okay to quit. That's what I learned. I don't need the boldest job. I don't want to be that guy anymore. And this article was from a longer feature by Hampton Sides that was originally published in Outside Magazine, used with permission, of course. And now from the Week magazine, we'll take a look at the Health and Science section. The first article here entitled Out of Africa Revised. A cache of ancient stone tools unearthed in the northern Arabian Peninsula could radically change our understanding of when and how our human ancestors left Africa. The consensus has been that Homo sapiens originated in Africa some 200,000 years ago and stayed there for roughly 140,000 years before dispersing via the Mediterranean coastline to the rest of the world. The 100,000 to 125,000-year-old tools that German archaeologist Hans-Peter Uppermann of the University of Tübingen found, however, suggests that the exodus happened 50,000 years earlier, along a route that passed over the narrow Red Sea and across a then-verdant Arabia. But because no fossil skeletons were found with the hand axes, scrapers, and cutting implements at the Jebel Faya rock shelter site, in the United Arab Emirates, there's no way to prove the tools belong to our direct ancestors as opposed to hominid species that have since died out. This is a huge milestone, Jeffrey Rose, an archaeologist at the University of Birmingham in England, tells the New York Times, but unfortunately it raises more questions than it answers. A Walk to Remember. If you're 55 or older, put down your crossword puzzle and take a stroll. Scientists have found that moderate aerobic activity can improve seniors' memory by reversing the slow wasting away of a key part of the brain, which begins at around 50. It used to be thought that aging was a one-way street that was going the wrong direction, University of Illinois professor Arthur Kramer tells Science News, but his recent study proves that that is not the case. Kramer and colleagues recruited 120 sedentary adults between the ages of 55 and 80. Half got their heart rates up by walking for 40 minutes, three times a week. The other half did stretching and weight exercises instead. After a year, scientists scanned each walker's brain and found that the hippocampus, where memories are formed, had grown by an average of 2%. By contrast, the stretcher's hippocampi had shrunk 1.4%, as expected. Though more study is needed, Kramer says initial results indicate that a brisk jaunt several times a week can roll back the pace of age-related memory loss by about 2 years. Bountiful Earths. Our galaxy, it turns out, is teeming with planets, and some of them probably resemble Earth, says Space.com. A new NASA survey conducted through its Kepler satellite has identified 1,235 possible planets outside our solar system, 54 of them in so-called habitable zones, where temperatures could allow liquid water and perhaps life to exist. The planet-hunting satellite, launched in March 2009, has already tripled the number of known planets by focusing its deep space camera on stars in just 0.25% of the sky. That suggests that planets are commonplace rather than exceptions. One distant solar system spotted by Kepler apparently has six planets. The data are game-changing, Willem Borucki, Kepler's principal investigator, tells Space.com. It's just a tremendous amount of new knowledge. Scientists will now focus on clues that indicate how Earth-like some of the exoplanets may be. I want to know whether these planets have atmospheres, says Borucki. The next item is entitled, Terrorism Alert Plants. Could daisies detect explosives better than bomb-sniffing dogs? 100 times better, says Colorado State University scientists who have genetically engineered greenery to turn white in the presence of tiny amounts of TNT. Because plants can't run and hide in the natural world, lead author June Medford tells Wired, they've evolved an ability to rapidly alter their structure when they detect a threat. Medford's team tweaked plants to be on guard against TNT and to respond to it by draining chlorophyll from leaves. She says the DNA code they used could work for any type of plant and a range of explosives. Researchers still need to reduce plants' reaction time, now a matter of hours, and to make the color change easier to spot. But the Departments of Defense and Homeland Security, both, which have spent millions on the project, hope to deploy a foliage force in about 3 years. And the final item in the health and science section today from the week, health scare of the week. A losing team can kill you. Just when it seemed things couldn't get any worse for diehard Steelers fans this past week, a new study suggests that the Packers' victory could literally kill them. Researchers at the University of Southern California examined Los Angeles County death records for the 2 weeks following the Rams' 1980 and 1984 Super Bowl appearances. After the hometown squad lost the first bout, local cardiac deaths spiked by 15% in men, 27% in women, and 22% in seniors. But when the Rams won the big game 4 years later, death rates didn't budge. Robert Cloner, the study's lead author, tells LiveScience.com that many fans see their team as a family member and become emotionally stressed watching its struggle for survival. High stakes, he says, can increase a fan's pulse rate, raise blood pressure, and potentially trigger a cardiac event. Now, in the last few minutes that we have left on our program today, let's take a look at a few items from Talking Points in the Week magazine. The first one, Watson, the first intelligent machine. When we look back from a ravaged future on the war between man and machine, said Tom Lamont in the London Observer, we may see this as the time the computer began its domination of the human race. Next week, which is of course happening this week, a cutting-edge IBM computer christened Watson will compete with two champion contestants on the quiz show Jeopardy. It could be a landmark moment in the evolution of artificial intelligence. Computers have been beating grandmasters at chess for decades, said Richard Powers in the New York Times, but Jeopardy for a machine is more challenging. Decoding the show's corny, convoluted clues requires a grasp of language, context, and nuance that only people have possessed so far. But Watson's designers fed a massively powerful new computer whose 2,500 parallel processors fill an entire room with several libraries worth of books and internet entries, all to create an intelligence as well-informed and supple as the smartest humans. In the best Jeopardy tradition, Watson is asking an intriguing question, namely, what is a human being? Couple of other smaller notes here. Excess body weight is now a global phenomenon, with 10% of the world's population, about 500 million adults, considered obese as measured by body mass index. About 23% of all U.S. workers now require licenses to do their jobs, with more than 1,110 professions regulated by various states. Among the jobs that require licenses in some states are florists, interior designers, manicurists, and shampoo specialists. Blacks, Asians, and Hispanics accounted for 79% of the U.S. growth in population between 2000 and 2009, according to census data. In 10 states, whites are now a minority among people 18 and younger, a harbinger of the future. This is a huge demographic transformation, said Brookings Institution demographer William H. Fry. And finally, President Obama's approval ratings reveal a stark partisan divide. 81% of Democrats approve of the job Obama is doing, while just 13% of Republicans approve. That gap of 68 points is second only to George W. Bush's, whose approval rating in his second term showed partisan gaps of up to 76 points. And we've run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long until next time.